You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the UN approves military action against rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Phil Clark and Martin Plaut will tell us whether they think an end is in sight to one of the region's most convoluted conflicts. Plus,
Honourable Shibangu, take your seat. I have not recognised you.
And he has not answered the question.
Honourable Shibangu, I will throw you out of the house.
That was the scene earlier this week in South Africa's parliament. We'll discuss whether the country's newest opposition party can make an impact. We'll also take a look at the situation in Afghanistan and find out why presidential candidate Abdullah Abdullah is angry at the UN. And...
what's your name?
My name's Bruce Wayne.
I promise you, I will find the man who did this.
We'll review the best in television this week, and we'll also speak to the editor of a new book all about the storytelling group The Moth. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So, as you would expect, rather a lot to pack in over the next 60 minutes. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the latest world news.
A UN report is accusing Islamic State militants of mass atrocities in Syria. It says public executions are common, children are recruited as fighters, and women have been flogged for breaching an Islamist dress code. The report follows 6 months of research interviewing some of those caught up in the violence in Syria. It's also accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons at least 8 times this year. Nigeria has ordered all schools in the country to remain closed for the first 6 weeks of the new term. They were due to reopen next week, but now they'll be shut until mid-October as part of efforts to curb the spread of Ebola. Only 5 of more than 1,400 deaths from the disease so far have been in Nigeria. Meanwhile, a doctor from Senegal who contracted Ebola in Sierra Leone is now in Germany for treatment. He's in a specialist isolation unit in Hamburg. Professor Ansfa Lusse is the clinic's director.
It was a very safe situation. All transport details worked extremely well. There was no danger to the public or to any workers of the rescue team or of the hospital at any time point. Therefore, we can reassure the community that no extra risk was taken.
The head of the International Monetary Fund has been placed under formal investigation over claims of negligence. Christine Lagarde is under suspicion over her role in awarding compensation of 400 million euros to a businessman who had previously supported the then president, Nicolas Sarkozy. Ms. Lagarde was part of a panel that awarded the payout. She says she has no intention of stepping down from the IMF. A recount of votes in Afghanistan's disputed presidential election has been temporarily halted after one of the candidates ordered his observers to withdraw. Both Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani had agreed to the UN-backed audit. Mr. Abdullah's supporters now say the process is worthless. Both men claim victory in June's runoff election, and both allege widespread fraud. The UN's Deputy Special Representative for Afghanistan, Nicholas Nesum, insists the audit is the only way to resolve the dispute.
The withdrawal is regrettable, but will not disrupt the completion of a robust and credible audit that will, to the best of our abilities, deliver a result that Afghan voters can have confidence in.
An open-ended ceasefire in Gaza is holding. The agreement ends 50 days of fighting between Israeli forces and the Palestinian militant group Hamas, in which more than 2,000 people have been killed. Thousands of people have returned to their homes in Gaza through the day. In the United States, police are investigating after a 9-year-old girl accidentally killed a gun instructor at a shooting range in Arizona. She was being taught how to use a machine gun but lost control of the weapon, killing Charles Vacca. Bob Irwin owns a gun store nearby.
From what I understand of this incident, it is extremely unusual. I have been at this now for 40 years. We've been having a machine gun rental now, and I've never heard of any of this happen.
China says it wants to restore relations with Vietnam after a dispute over sovereignty in the South China Sea. The dispute centered on an oil rig placed by China in waters claimed by Vietnam. China's premier says both countries should be friendly to each other, speaking as a senior figure from Vietnam's Communist Party arrived in Beijing. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul Osborne. It's 18:05 here in London. It's 13:05 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'm joined today by Phil Clark from the School of Oriental and African Studies and Martin Plout from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Phil and Martin, welcome to you both. We're going to focus mainly on Africa over the next 25 minutes or so. And we're going to begin with Congo. The UN Security Council has called for the swift neutralisation of rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern region. The FDLR, which was born out of the Hutu militia that committed the genocide in neighbouring Rwanda 20 years ago, has been fighting in Congo for the best part of two decades. Previous attempts have been made to disarm them. Martin Plout, does anything make you think that this time it will be different?
Well, I suppose the thing that is different about this is that the Rwandan-backed militias are not inside the Congo at the moment. They've been defeated, the M23, at least most of them, and you know, they are now no longer a threat. So in a sense, you're left with the Hutu. The Tutsi-based rebels have gone. Now you're left with the Hutu rebels. Can they be wound up? I have my doubts. As you pointed out, this is two decades old. It's been going on. They cannot all have come out of Rwanda at that time. They must have local support. There are about 1,200 or something of them left. I would be surprised if you can get rid of them that easily.
And Phil Clark, to put this into context, Eastern Congo, you know, we're talking about a region that, unlike the rest of the country, has had a lot of different militia groups over the last 15, 20 years. Martin mentioned the M23, which was just the latest iteration of the Rwandan-backed, predominantly Tutsi rebel groups that were operating there. The FDLR were their opponents. But also, let's face it, the Congolese army, the FAR, RDC, as they're known, they're not a bunch of nice guys either, are they? It's a very complicated area.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the big reasons why the FDLR has been such a threat in the region for as long as it has is that it's always got very strong support from the Congolese army. So one of the difficulties at the moment in trying to neutralize this rebel force is that the UN has to get the cooperation of Kabila's government in Kinshasa, and Kabila seems very reluctant to do this. So there are difficult political games here. It's not just a military enterprise.
It's interesting as well, Martin, that this is the UN Security Council that's taken this decision. Rwanda at the moment has a seat on the UN Security Council, so has been intimately involved in these discussions. Rwanda and Congo have had, let's say, a troubled recent past. But the two presidents, Paul Kagame in Rwanda and Joseph Kabila in Congo, have had moments, haven't they, where they've been in agreement. And indeed, only 5 years ago, Kabila and Kagame operated together to allow Rwandan forces to cross over the border, legitimately, unlike illegitimately, where they might have done before, to try and take on the FDLR.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're much more closely tied than that as well. I mean, don't forget that it was the Rwandans who put his father into power. So in Kinshasa, they marched across the entire width of Congo in gumboots and put him in power. They overthrew Mobutu. So, I mean, the relationship is very close, or has been very close, and very bitter at the same time. Because, Rwanda does see this as their backyard. They are worried about incursions into Rwanda by the Hutu. And there are some Rwandans even who claim that this is traditionally their part of their territory and should have been part of Rwanda.
Just on that issue, Martin, this the threat that Kagame raises quite often, particularly when he's trying to defend himself against claims that he's been cracking down too much on what's left of the opposition inside Rwanda. He'll say, well, look, the FDLR, they're right there over the border. They want to come back into Rwanda and continue the genocide. That's his argument. Does that stand up in any way?
Well, I think it certainly does. And I mean, precisely for that reason, I brought along a poem by C.P. Cavafy. You may remember him, the Alexandrian, famous poem called The Barbarians at the Gate. And it ends like this. It says, and some of those who have just returned from the border say that they are no barbarians any longer. And now, what's going to happen to us without the barbarians? They were, those people, a kind of a solution. It's a very famous poem. And in a sense, that is the problem for the Rwandans now. If they get rid of the FDLR, who will be the barbarians?
Because it has helped Kagame somewhat, hasn't it, Phil Clark, having those barbarians at the gate?
Certainly. I mean, Kagame's ruling party has gained legitimacy because of this narrative that they were the liberators after the genocide, that they were the country that brought peace and stability to Rwanda. They beat the genocidal forces. And so it's always been useful for Kagame to be able to say, look, there's a genuine threat across the border. I mean, I see kind of two big issues at the moment. I mean, the first one, I think, is exactly what Martin's already alluded to, which is even if the FDLR is neutralized, and that's a very big if, what will Rwanda's response be? This could be a game changer in that it could remove from Rwanda the major motivation for meddling in inside Congo. So we have to wait and see what Rwanda does. The second issue, I think, perhaps is even bigger than that, which is even if we get rid of a group like the FDLR, what will be done about the fundamental weakness of the Congolese state? And I think that most of the tensions, most of the volatility we've seen in eastern Congo recently partly has to do with these rebel groups, but has even more to do with the weakness of Kabila's regime. And until institutional reform takes place, until the security sector is fundamentally reformed, I think we're going to see a range of very deep problems continue. So I think those are the two big questions that remain to be answered.
I
just want to jump in on one point, which is in the last week, there have been three major Rwandan arrests of people right at the heart of the regime. What's that about?
I think this is perhaps one of the issues about Rwanda that often gets overlooked. We often talk about Kagame's government as being very strong, very cohesive. It's one of the most functional states in the region. But it's also fundamentally a very divided state. It's a very divided government. And Kagame seems to be increasingly worried about dissent and potential defectors from within his own party. And I think the arrest in the last week are the kind of the latest manifestation of that. There's a certain paranoia within the government. Kagame, I think, is worried even about former military allies of his and seems to be reining them in and using military law as a means to do that. So it shows that this is internally a very fragile state in Rwanda at the moment.
I want to cross back over the border, as it were, into Congo. And Martin Platt, when we talk about the UN's role here, this is the largest peacekeeping force the UN has. It's 22,000 troops now there, going under the name of MONUSCO. MONUSCO, it's been there for a very long time. It costs more than $1 billion a year. The international community has also been paying for the elections. In 2006, they paid for what were the first elections, democratic elections in 40 years in Congo. And yet all these questions that Phil raises, saying over security sector, about building strong institutions, those questions were being asked 10, 15 years ago as well. Do you feel that any progress has been made, or is it perhaps that we can sort of say, well, look, it hasn't got, the UN has helped it not get any worse?
I think the latter. It hasn't got any worse. But I mean, the UN is also at times part of the problem. I mean, I went there, I reported from there, and, we interviewed people who showed us the gold that they had traded with the UN forces in order to get guns. Some of the rebels actually got their guns from the UN forces, but these were Indian and Pakistani troops, and they were bored. They were in the middle of nowhere as far as they were concerned. Some of them hadn't been paid by their own governments for months. Because don't forget, the UN has no troops of its own. They only have troops on loan, and those troops still actually always refer back to their home governments. So, you know,
the if we're serious about sorting this out, then we perhaps don't want to have the Bangladeshi Air Force doing it for us then.
Well, let's put it this way. They aren't exactly the same kind of forces as, shall we say, some Western forces might be if they were put into the field.
Phil, it's a big country and a big problem, and it's been going on for some time. Is there a are there steps towards a solution that you think could have been taken at the moment that aren't being looked at?
Yeah, I think the answer from day one had to be political, and I think this is what the foreign donors and the UN have shied away from, is the need for deep political reform and in encouraging a type of government in Kinshasa that would be considered legitimate by the bulk of the Congolese population. Kabila continues to get almost unwavering support from the international community, even though he's been shown to be enormously violent and corrupt and inept at running the state. So I think until there is a reasonable political process put in place with viable opposition, where we see judicial, security, police sector reform, and until some sort of genuine deep peace and stability is brought to the east of the country, this is just going to be a cycle. And you can remove Rwanda and the FDLR from the equation, but those sorts of things will go on until that kind of political reform takes place.
And just finally, before we move on to another topic, Martin Plaut, Joseph Kabila is supposed to be stepping down very soon. His term ends in 2016. The Constitution says he can only stand for two terms. He's already, let's say, feeling slightly ambivalent about whether he's going to do that. And Western diplomats seem to be in no mood to really put the screws on him to step away.
Well, I think he's just destined to become another one of Africa's great dinosaurs there for ever and a day. And one can always find, you know, a little group that gets up and demands your presence. It's an outrage. You'd love to step down, you know, throw away the cares of office, but goodness me, the people love me. I can't do it. That's easy.
And I'm sure the West will perhaps let them do that. Let's turn now to the political crisis brewing in South Africa. Perhaps a bit strong to call it a political crisis. But last week, MPs from the Economic Freedom Fighters Party disrupted a session in Parliament. They were calling on President Jacob Zuma to repay public money allegedly spent on his private home security. Let's listen to some of that debate.
Honourable Speaker.
Honorable Shibambu, take your seat.
There's a question about Honorable
Shibambu,
of the money.
Take
is the
your seat.
The money?
I have not recognized you.
And he has not answered the question.
Honorable
of
Shibambu,
the money. That is what I'm
I will
for
throw
here.
You out of the house. I will throw you out of the house if you don't listen.
That was the EFF's Julius Malema there talking with, debating with, as it were, the country's speaker. Martin Plaut, bearing in mind that you were previously working for one of the other opposition groups in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance, in some ways, is this a good thing? You know, that there's an opposition group that's prepared to, yes, it's a stunt, occupying Parliament in that way and in their red overalls and their red miners' helmets. But this is democracy in action in a strange sort of way, isn't it?
It is, but the problem is that the ANC has become, over 20 years, very used to dealing with opposition parties which, shall we say, play the game. You know, they raise points of order, they put forward motions, they debate in the House, they sit on committees, they ask questions. And the ANC, frankly, since they have an overwhelming majority and think they will always have an overwhelming majority, turn around and say, well, you know, they give them non-answers. And frankly, that was the problem. President Zuma gave a complete non-answer to the question of when he was going to repay this money. And there's no allegation about it, as you said in the beginning. He has been told by one of the judicial authorities, Thuli Madonsela, who's the public protector, that he has to repay some of this money because it was used for things which were entirely personal and had nothing to do with his security, which is all it was supposed to be about. And so the economic freedom fighters, unlike the Democratic Alliance, who played by the rules, just started. They bring hard hats, you know, from building sites into the chamber. They just started whacking them on the chamber and getting up. There were even more rowdy scenes when they were saying, you know, pay back the money, pay back the money, pay back the money. Whoa, and the place descended into chaos. I mean, it came close to the riot police being brought into the chamber.
Phil Clark, it's I don't see the problem with that. That's, you know, when you're looking at a situation where you've got a dominant political party that is getting more than 60% of the vote in election after an election, and you know, as Martin says, doesn't seem to be prepared to even abide by the rules when it comes to, in this case, you know, the president paying back the money. The fact that, you know, there's this small upstart opposition party that's prepared to bend the rules itself, that's surely no bad thing.
Yes, I think the EFF have, to a certain extent, been driven to this. I'm not sure they have too many other political options. That said, it's a little bit hard to swallow watching Julius Malema stand up and suddenly be the voice of reason and probity, especially when it comes to financial issues, given that he's got corruption charges brought against him at the moment. I mean, you could argue that in many ways he's just being opportunist. Once again, he's kind of jumping on the public protector's bandwagon here. We didn't hear Malema saying very much about the Kundler case when it first broke. He seems to be kind of a bit of a Johnny come lately here. So probably a reasonable argument, but difficult to hear it coming from him.
And Martin Plout, your former colleagues in the Democratic Alliance, where are they now? Where do they go from here? Because, you know, the danger is certainly, I mean, look, international media doesn't really matter to a great, you know, in a great sense, but they're being overtaken as, you know, Julius Malema is now seen as being the voice of opposition in South Africa.
Well, I don't think that's quite true. I mean, he is seen as the man making the political weather, shall we say. But, you know, there is something that's much more worrying in all of this, which is that the ANC, particularly Gwede Mantashe, who's the general secretary, but also a member of the Politburo of the Communist Party, has begun referring to, and this is now over a couple of years, to Malema as a fascist. Now, there's only one way that the communists think you deal with fascists, and that is through violence. And the Malema and the economic freedom fighters are now saying, look, there are people coming into parliament now chanting, kill Malema. It's getting very tense. And, you know, South Africa has a wonderful ability to step back from the precipice, but it would be not difficult to go over it.
Martin Plout and Phil Clark, thank you both for now. When we come back in a moment, we'll be talking about Nigeria's schools, and we'll also have the latest from Afghanistan.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It is 18:23 here in London, at 17:23 in Accra, 13:23 on the east coast of the US. Still with me, Phil Clark from the School of Oriental and African Studies and Martin Plout from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies. Let's turn now to Nigeria. Earlier today, the country's education minister ordered that schools would remain closed until at least the middle of October to give staff time to learn more about the latest Ebola outbreak in the country. Nigeria first reported a case of the disease back in July, and five people have since died. More than 1,400 people are known to have been killed in West Africa, where the outbreak first began. Martin Plout, all countries across West Africa are trying to work out how to cope with this crisis. Obviously, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Guinea more so than others. But in Nigeria, this is yet another issue when it comes to education that the country has to deal with, which it really wouldn't have been expecting.
Absolutely. On the other hand, the Nigerians have really dealt with this one much better than I thought they would. I mean, Nigeria is a pretty chaotic kind of place. But, you know, this is the 37th day since they woke up to the fact that they had Ebola on their patch. I mean, it was brought there by Patrick Sawyer, who flew in from, I think it was Liberia, and touched down a couple of places. And he was deeply ill, and he then spread it to people who were looking after him. But, you know, they only now have one active case, down from 13. And yes, people have died, but they seem to have managed to get this under control in a way that is pretty impressive. And, you know, I think for you know, I'm certainly not, it wouldn't be, you know, standing back and not criticizing Nigeria if, under normal circumstances. But I think on this one, they've done a pretty good job. And, you know, closing down your schools may be a pretty radical step, but, you know, you don't want to get this into the wider population. I don't quite see, frankly, where the closing the schools fits in. But nonetheless, if they feel that's necessary, they've done a good job, we should give them the benefit of the doubt.
Phil Clark, do you think that the way that governments in West Africa have dealt with Ebola, and obviously it has differed from nation to nation, but often in a lot of the coverage, it's about how Western aid groups or hospitals are dealing with this. And there's been very little really about, you know, action taken at a governmental level.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with Martin about Nigeria and would say the same about Guinea. I think Guinea also, perhaps it's been underreported, it just seems to have dealt with Ebola quite effectively, that their numbers of cases have also decreased in the last few weeks. It seems to be Liberia where the bulk of the problems are. Certainly the largest number of Ebola cases has been there. I think the big difference is that Liberia decided to deal with this first and foremost as a military and a security issue, whereas it seems that Guinea and Nigeria saw this almost immediately as a public health issue, and so had to kind of mobilize their public health ministries and infrastructure to deal with it. That seems to have fundamentally been a much more effective approach. So I think you're right, too, that all the emphasis has been on sort of outside saviors and rescuers coming in, and that's been, I think, a very important part of this, and people from the outside have certainly put themselves on the line. But let's not forget that I think, at least in the case of Nigeria and Guinea, the responses of African governments has actually been quite effective here.
And just finally, before I let you go, let's turn briefly to the situation in Afghanistan. There's been an election. We still don't know who the next president's going to be because there's been all sorts of accusations over fraud. And one of the candidates, Abdullah, has now said that he's pulling out from a UN-supervised audit of the votes. The entire audit has now been suspended. Martin Plaut, until this stage, until it happened right now, the fact that the way the outcome of the election had been dealt with through relatively peaceful means, through protests, through the court system, suggested that some progress had been made in terms of Afghan democracy, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But, you know, the problem is, in a sense, the person who pulls out from this audit really tells you everything you need to know about it. Why did he pull out? Well, because he was going to lose. And, you know, that is the difficulty. You know, Afghanistan is such a fragmented and shattered country, both through war and through the internal warlords and various clans and factions. You know, it's winner takes all. And quite frankly, he didn't fancy losing. So I suppose that's why he's pulled out.
Phil Clark, there is still talk that there will be some sort of national unity government. The differences in policies between Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani aren't that enormous, certainly on certain key issues, including security. Would you still put your money on the fact that there will be some sort of negotiated settlement?
I think there's going to have to be, if only because the US and the UN are so hell-bent on that being the solution. We've got a perverse situation at the moment with the US and the UN, who've been observing this audit process, have now forced Afghan Ghani, the other presidential candidate, to also withdraw from the audit process so that this looks even. This is kind of Keystone Cops form of democracy. But look, the globe loves power-sharing arrangements. This seems to be one of the classic remedies to try and deal with, you know, conflict and fracturous political moments. If we look around the world at other power-sharing approaches, Kenya, Zimbabwe and elsewhere, it doesn't tend to work particularly well. I think Afghanistan perhaps is going to go down an equally perilous road here.
Come on, we have a power-sharing government in Britain. What's wrong with this?
My point exactly.
Don't let's get started on that. Martin Plaut and Phil Clark, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be in Tallinn. We'll be reviewing the best of the new TV, and we'll be also hearing all about the storytelling collective known as The Moth. But first, here's Paul Osborne with the world news headlines.
A UN report has accused Islamic State militants in Syria of committing mass atrocities. It says public executions are used to terrorize local populations and children are being recruited as fighters. The report also says the Syrian government's used chemical weapons at least 8 times this year. The head of the International Monetary Fund has been placed under formal investigation over claims of negligence. Christine Lagarde is under suspicion in France over her role in awarding compensation of 400 million euros to a businessman who'd previously been a big supporter of the then-president Nicolas Sarkozy. She says there's no truth in the allegations and will not step down from the IMF. Nigeria has ordered all schools in the country to remain closed for the first 6 weeks of the new term. They were due to reopen next week, but they'll be shut until mid-October as part of efforts to curb the spread of Ebola. And a recount of votes in Afghanistan's disputed presidential election has been temporarily halted after one of the candidates ordered his observers to withdraw. Both Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani agreed to the UN-backed audit. Now Mr. Abdullah's supporters say the process is worthless. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much indeed. It is 2032 in Istanbul, 1832 here in London. We're heading, though, to Tallinn, where Liz Kansep can join us now. Liz, thank you very much for coming on Midori House. A lot happening in Estonia at the moment. Let's begin with the big visit that I believe that many in Estonia are rather excited about. President Barack Obama will be touching down in Tallinn at the start of September before he heads over to Wales for the NATO summit. What sort of reception can Obama expect in Tallinn?
I think the reception here is going to be very grand indeed, because I think Estonians are very excited about this very surprising visit, I should say. The news broke out about 2 weeks ago, and today we found out that Barack Obama is actually going to spend the night in Tallinn as well, which was not originally in the plan. And he's heading straight to Wales to the NATO summit from Tallinn on the 3rd of September.
And obviously this comes at a time when a number of Baltic states, including Estonia, are concerned about Russian action in Ukraine. There's been a lot of talk from those in Eastern Europe saying that, look, there are no NATO bases in the Baltic states and in the countries which neighbour Russia. This is something that should be talked about. The fact that Obama is making this visit on the eve of the NATO summit, do people in Estonia feel that this is at least sending a message that the bigger nations within NATO haven't forgotten the smaller ones?
I think they at least hope it is so. A lot of the politicians here have been saying that this visit is very symbolic, especially because it happens right before the NATO summit, because Mr. Obama is coming from Washington, he's going to make a stop in Tallinn and then head to Wales. And they are saying that it's a sign that that the US is really supporting Estonia and they will not leave us alone. And they keep, of course, repeating that Estonia is one of the four NATO members who spends 2% of their GDP on defense.
There's a one other story that's making headlines in Estonia is this new civil partnership bill that is currently being talked about in Parliament. Who is it that's which parties have proposed this, and how is it going down in Estonia?
Well, it's a very, very controversial matter. It's really divided the society. A lot of younger people support the bill, and a lot of the older people don't support the bill. The parties are mixed as well. Some of the parties, there is no unanimity among the parties either. It's like some members of different parties support it and some don't. And we've seen a lot of action about this bill during the last past months. It's basically, I think, the most important matter that's been talked about among or besides Ukraine.
And do you find that it's actually being talked about amongst ordinary people in bars and cafes? Is it a topic of discussion, or is it mainly limited to people who take an interest in politics?
No, I think it's something that everybody talks about, because one NGO that is really campaigning against it, because they say that this is a threat to the traditional family, traditional families. So they are saying that this bill is actually gay propaganda, and it's to give special rights to gay people, which is not actually true, because this bill is gender neutral. So it doesn't really mean that two men or two women who want to be together and want to register their partnership are the only ones who can do this. This is also for straight people and also for maybe a little bit unseen family patterns. Because we see a lot of people leaving Estonia at the moment. A lot of people go to work in Finland, and then maybe two friends who are just friends, they want to share a flat and they want to raise their kids together without sharing a bedroom, so they can actually sign this contract as well.
And just finally, let's talk about, we couldn't not talk to someone in Estonia without talking about digital matters, Estonia being one of the leading digital countries, particularly when it comes to government issues. And now the country is talking about opening digital embassies so that in case anything bad really happens, the state can still function online. Tell us about this.
Very interesting, I think. And I, as an Estonian who was very into e-solutions, I also find it a little bit strange, but also a little bit cool. So what the government wants to do is they want to rent servers in different friendly countries so that we can save our backup country systems in different countries. This means that if somebody should or would evade us, then the country would still be able to run on a normal basis, more or less, because all the data and everything is stored somewhere else, not here in Estonia.
Lise Kangsepp, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Tallinn. In a moment, we'll be talking about the moth.
Each year, Monocle publishes its ranking of the top 25 cities for quality of life. These most livable cities in the world get the essentials right, and for 2014, Copenhagen scores a hat trick as Monocle's number one city for the third time.
All of the Nordic capitals, they're incredibly close, there's no question, and they all do a number of things incredibly well. But there's something about Copenhagen, it's just that little bit further south, and it's just a bit looser around the edges. There's a little bit more license to do things, maybe on your own terms.
Monocle takes a cinematic look at the top cities in our 2014 Quality of Life survey, now showing in the films menu on monocle.com.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1839 here in London, 1339 in New York. The greatest stories are true and told without notes. That's the ethos of the New York-based storytelling organisation The Moth, founded in 1997 by poet and novelist George Dawes Green. Since then, The Moth has seen over 10,000 stories told by everyone from astronauts, librarians to war veterans. Their tales span topics of life, death, laughter, tears, and just about everything in between. In The Moth, This is a True Story, the group's artistic director, Catherine Burns, takes stories from the stage and puts them into print. And Catherine Burns joins us now in the studio. Catherine, welcome to Midori House. Tell us, first of all, how this began, and in telling us that story, hopefully without notes, where the name The Moth came from as well.
Yeah, so George grew up on an island off the coast of Georgia, which is a part of the southern part of the United States. And he and his friends would sit around, sort of infamously now, on his friend Wanda's porch, and they would tell stories and drink whiskey. And there was a hole in the screen, and the moths would come through and sort of flutter around the light bulbs. And so they started calling themselves the Moths. They would say, the Moths will meet tonight. So when George got to New York, he just felt like everybody just talked in sound bites and nobody could sit still to listen to anybody else for more than a minute. And so he wanted to recreate that feeling of sitting around on a porch, drinking and telling longer very personal stories. And so he said that he was going to have a moth night at his apartment in New York. And it was a huge success. And it just took off from there. And it's been 17 years.
17 years. And
yes.
And so far, has it all been in New York or mainly in the U.S.?
It's almost exclusively been in the U.S. We've done a few shows in Australia, a couple in Edinburgh, one in Tajikistan, of all places.
Wow.
But what's exciting about London is that not only are we doing a main stage show, but we have an open mic story slam contest, and we're launching it monthly here. So it'll be the first show, like permanent show outside of the U.S.
And that's what interests me about this is that it's not just, you know, great writers, great
right.
storytellers, or people whose job it is to be a great storyteller who do this. Although, I mean, in the book, I look through and it's Malcolm Gladwell, it's Adam Gopnik, brilliant writers, great storytellers. But you have a lot of people who really don't do this for a day job at all.
Right. I mean, I think that's what we pride ourselves on, finding people who would never come to us on their own, but who have unbelievable stories to tell, because there are so many people like that. Like, one of our favorite storytellers in the book is Sherman O.T. Powell, who we actually met in a homeless shelter in New York. I mean, now he's doing very well. But he tells a story in there about making hooch in Attica in prison. And that's somebody who might just not, you know, be a hipster, walk into, you know, our Soho story slams in New York. But he has wonderful stories that, you know, people love hearing.
Have you ever found yourself, you know, on the bus or on the subway or in a restaurant, and you overhear someone telling a story and you're like, right, we need to get them on? Have there been cases of that?
There have been. I mean, one of my favorite things that can happen to me is I'll just be at a party and someone will walk up to me and say, I don't know why, but my friend says I have to tell you this story, and it's a bit personal, and this is totally weird, but she insists, and I'm like, oh my God. And some of our best storytellers have come. One of the stories in the book is Stephanie Somerville telling a story about being she's an African-American woman who was a home health aid worker, and she was, unbeknownst to her, sent to a home of a dying member of the Ku Klux Klan to take care of him. And that was one of these things where she was like, my friend Sandy says I have to tell you the story. I'm like, what?
Does that make parties for you fun, or sometimes like, oh God, I've got to listen to this person's story, it might not be very good?
No, it actually makes them very fun. I always say that when I get sick of listening to stories, then somebody else should take my job because I don't deserve it anymore.
Fair enough. now, we mentioned the book, and this is a collection of 50 of the
yes.
the stories that have been told over the years. Now, given the fact that, as you say, these are stories told without notes, they're told at these events, how have you been able to, you know, keep a record? Is this partly about just trying to remember what you heard in, you know, in 2001, or, you know, someone wrote a review of one in 2005? Yeah, oh, yes, there was that one.
Oh, as far as picking them, well, they're all recorded. And so we've recorded them almost from the beginning. And so, yeah, I mean, it was overwhelming. At the time we sat down to edit the book, we were at 10,000 stories told.
Did you listen to all 10,000 again, or was it?
We did not. But okay. At some point, we eliminated the slam stories, which are 5 minutes, because we felt like they were just too short to hold up against the main stage stories that are curated, and they're like 10 to 12 minutes, and so it was just hard to compare them. So we eliminated all of that. And so that eliminated like 7,000 stories. And then we ended up kind of just going through, and partly from our own memory, partly from like stories that maybe had been in, we have CDs and like other things in the past. We went through and we ended up transcribing 300 stories and reading them all. And then from there, it was like such a painful process of, you know, the cutting room floor, pulling them down until we got to 50. It was originally meant to be 40, but we couldn't decide. So it's 50.
Okay. Well, there's always a chance to a second volume.
Hopefully.
Now, when you've done these events outside of the US, have you found a different type of story or a different type of storytelling?
To some degree. I mean, I remember our first show in the UK was in Edinburgh at the Book Festival in 2009. And we did a show, and it was very interesting to see what people reacted to. Like stories that, like, we had a couple stories up that are so popular in the US, like some of the favorite stories. But I think the Brits were, as an American, if I were to sort of typecast it, were a little like, oh, these self-absorbed Americans and their therapy oversharing. And we're like, So, you know, and I think there is a different sensibility here, and one that we want to be very mindful of. You know, I think that this, what's going to emerge over the next year, is a British version of the moth. It's going to be a little bit different from what we've been doing in New York.
We're a bit more
reserved. That's going to be exciting. Maybe a little bit more reserved, but that's okay.
Okay.
You know, some of our greatest storytellers, even who are Americans, can be a little bit more reserved. So, and it's interesting. And, you know, there are definitely stories like that were told in the Tajikistan story show that were told in a very different way. Like someone sang in Tajik, and that doesn't generally happen in New York.
No. People don't tend to sing in Tajik in New York. But, well, yeah. You know, sometimes.
Sometimes, perhaps.
Certain clubs.
Yes.
Catherine Burns, thank you very much indeed. The book is called The Moth. It's out now. There's a podcast which you can Google it. You'll find it. You can download it. And if you're in London, sold out tonight or tomorrow night indeed, but then on. There'll be other shows, won't
indeed.
There? Okay. Catherine Burns, thank you very much indeed. In a moment, we're going to be talking about The Week in TV with Alice Vincent. But first, bit of music. This is TV on the Radio with Will Do. That was TV on the Radio with Will Do. And what you wouldn't have heard is as soon as that came on, Catherine Burns from The Moth said, oh my God, the lead singer of this, he's spoken at The Moth before. See, everyone does it. Everyone does it. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Before we end the show, time for our weekly review of the world of television. We're joined by Alice Vincent from The Telegraph. Alice, hello.
Hello.
We are going to talk about True Detective eventually. We'll do that at the end. But first, Gotham.
Yeah.
Gotham, as the name suggests, has a bit of a Batman link, doesn't it?
Yeah, quite a strong one. It's the creation story, the origin story, perhaps.
Everything needs a creation story now, doesn't it? Every drama needs
Maybe running out of things to do, I don't know. But yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of them around at the moment. This one looks quite good, though. I mean, It's quite a big thing to tackle when you've got that brilliant Dark Knight trilogy. Mm.
Which in itself, I mean, Batman Begins, the first of that trilogy, as the name suggests, was supposed to be, you know, a bit of a creation story. Anyway, let's hear a bit of the trailer and then you can tell us what you think of it.
What's your name?
My name's Bruce Wayne.
I promise you, I will find the man who did this.
I'm learning to conquer fear.
Fear doesn't need conquering. Fear tells you where the edge is.
Somebody has to take over. It might as well be me.
Gotham is on a knife edge.
This is not a city for nice guys.
Don't rush him!
However dark and scary the world might be right now, there will be light. There will be light.
There will be light.
There we are. Gotham, it launches in the US on Fox later in September. Alice, what do you make of it? Do you think it's got the potential to be a big hit?
I think it's going to be well loved. Already there's so much buzz about it because, as the clip might have suggested, we're meeting Bruce Wayne literally as he's been orphaned. You know, he's like this kid who's just lost his parents. Ben McKenzie plays James Gordon, and that's the detective, which is played by Gary Oldman in the films.
Who becomes Commissioner Gordon.
Exactly, yeah. And I think the really fun thing about it is that you see all of the baddies when they're little as well. So you've got this kind of bendy teenage cat girl, cat woman, and you've got Poison Ivy looking like a creepy gothy teenager, and the Joker's a teenager. And I kind of like that high school Batman element.
Is it going to be like Smallville, which was, you know, the Superman when they were kids drama, which I must say, I was going to slag it off. I did actually rather enjoy the first series, but, you know, became a little bit...
I wasn't a giant Smallville fan. I'm really hoping it's not because it looks incredibly moody and it looks very dark, and you've still got that whole context of a very crime-ridden, gritty city of Gotham. And... yeah, I mean, I think that's good. Plus, it's rooted in DC Comics and all the DC Comics characters, and I think that gives it some credence.
Okay. Let's talk now about Outlander. Before we hear what you think, Alice, let's hear a little bit of it.
Something happened to me. I was on my honeymoon in 1945.
I distinctly heard the barman refer to us as Sassenachs.
I hope you didn't take offence.
It only means Englishman, or at worst, Outlander.
A word to the wise, be careful after dark.
The world just spun out of control.
Claire?
I know it doesn't make any sense. But I seem to have fallen through time.
Happens to me all the time. Outlander, based on a series of novels, which is a sort of a bit of a mix of time travel, historical saga, romance. It's already, and I hate doing this, but it's already been dubbed the new Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Is it potentially?
Well, it doesn't have any dragons.
Oh, okay. Well, it loses points.
It is promised a lot of sex and a lot of violence. So that's where its Game of Thrones points come in.
Is it as clever, though? Possibly.
Well, the thing is, it's got a lot of similarities. I mean, I haven't read the Game of Thrones novels, and I haven't read the Outlander novels, but it's generating a similar level of interest. I think it's unfair for Outlander to be dubbed the new Game of Thrones just because it should be allowed to stand on its own merit, or lack of. But there is a lot of internet interest, and one of my favourite facts about the fans is that they are so fascinated with Outlander and Scotland that wherever they're from, they speak in this kind of faux Scottish dialect online, which is just kind of, I don't know, that's the level of fanaticism these books have incited. So... we haven't.
You're not selling it to me.
No, but I think it's interesting because even though it doesn't have a UK channel yet, it isn't. You know, it's enormous. It's just launched in America. I think it's one to keep an eye on, even if it shows how good Game of Thrones really is.
Okay, there we are. Finally, True Detective. There is going to be a second season.
Mm-hmm.
Let's, without giving too much away, partly because I still haven't seen season one. And I think that's fair enough because, you know, it was only on a few months ago and it wasn't really on everywhere in the world. So, you know, let's try not to spoil everything that's going to happen. It was, you know, seen as being one of the, you know, the greatest TV dramas of the last few years. Is it possible that the second season can live up to the first, or is that going to be quite a high hurdle?
Well, it's an interesting one because True Detective is an anthology series. So a bit like American Horror Story, every new season you get a whole new plot, a whole new cast. I mean, they're doing the same with Fargo. It's a very Vogue thing at the moment. So it doesn't matter if you've not seen the first season because the second one's completely different. Is it going to live up to it? They've got a big... You know, the second season got a lot to live up to, even though it really missed out at the Emmys. They've said that the writing's going to be as good, and by the casting rumours, you're going to have a pretty good cast.
I mean, that's the other thing. You're not going to struggle for great actors in this after, you know, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey have done it. It will be a lot easier for big name film stars to switch to it because they won't just see it as, oh, well, a normal TV series. They'll see it as something different and special.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of people are liking to say that, oh, this was the TV show that cemented the move from, you know, for actors to go from Hollywood to TV. And one of the most ridiculous casting rumours that first came out was that Brad Pitt was going to be involved. And it's not been denied yet, but I think it would be unlikely. But we have, you know, people, you know, like Colin Farrell. I'm most interested to see if the Elizabeth Moss rumour is going to come true. She played Peggy in Mad Men and the detective in Top of the Lake, and she was very good in that. And I think she's going to play this kind of hard-drinking, hard-nailed cop in the second season.
And for many of us, she is still Zoe Bartlett in The West Wing.
And that as well, yeah.
Indeed. US dramas, without wishing to generalise, but they don't tend to know when to end, do they? If something's been a success, it's like, we will keep hammering this until the very end. There's none of this, well, season one of Homeland was brilliant, let's just end it right there with him blowing himself up. No, we'll keep him alive and drag this out over another 2, 3, 4 seasons. Perhaps less danger with something like True Detective because of, as you say, it's an anthology series.
Yeah, and the writing is so good on it. I think that is a thing, and so hopefully it won't continue with the terror. The worst thing that happens to an American TV series is they kind of string out the same plot and things stop happening. So True Detective is all about the plot, it's all about the writing, and from what the rumours going around, it's going to be very dramatic.
Okay. Alice Vincent from The Telegraph, thank you very much indeed. True Detective Season 2 won't be around for a while, but don't worry, you can still watch Season 1, which I'm sure most of you haven't actually watched. That's all we've got time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to all our guests, but in particular, Phil Clark and Martin Plaut. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn. It was researched by David Pleasant and Rebecca Unger. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next up, after the headlines, it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. Do stay tuned all through the evening to Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily comes to you at 2200 hours here in London. That's 1700 hours if you are on the East Coast. Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.